Welcome to On the Money. We're here to delve into your finance questions and unpack the jargon around business, banks, and big bickies. On the Money is coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. On the Money, the buck stops with us. I'm your host, Catherine Zengerer. This week on The Money, the government is set to introduce a tax on bank deposits in its latest scramble for cash before the budget.
This is akin to allowing the criminals to run the victim compensation process. Further to this, Dr. Brendan French is overseeing this program. To every victim of CBA, this is a slap in the face.
We take a look at the compensation scheme being proposed for people who've been ripped off by bad financial advice, and which credit card should you pay off first, the one with the smallest debt or the one with the highest interest. We take a look at a new study on people's debt habits and whether they work. That's all coming up. You're on the Money. The Treasurer's Financial System Inquiry has highlighted a revenue measure that will in part offset the cost of the government guarantee the banks got during the GFC. Joe Hockey has suggested a bank deposit tax to be paid by the banks. Trouble is, will it be long before the banks pass on this cost back to us? Roderick Chambers reports.
Well, I certainly don't agree with any tax like that on deposits. Not at all. I think the GST could be raised.
Well, I suspect that the banks won't pay the tax, that the people who are banking their money will pay the tax. And it's going to discourage people from saving. And we need people to actually be saving their money. So if they're going to have to pay a tax on this meagre savings, they're not going to save them. That's what I think.
That'll upset me, mate. Yeah, it'll upset me.
Bank customers there giving their view on the proposed bank deposit tax, an idea that came out of the Financial Systems Inquiry. We'll have to wait until budget night to see if it gets included, but I asked Professor Brian Andrew of the University of Wollongong why this tax should be imposed and who will end up paying.
For a long time, the finance industry has been bloated with huge profits and no capacity to pay, so it's necessary to limit some of that. And share some of the wealth across the community. Now, a tax paid by the banks is what they're afraid of on their deposits, but they would presumably work to pass it on to the individual depositors. So eventually it would be paid by us, but it would be a proportional tax, which is not particularly fair. It would hit low-income earners worse than high-income earners proportionately, but if it was cut off at a certain balance level, it could be targeted to high-income earners.
I've also been told that it could affect the smaller banks more so than the larger banks.
Yes, that's possible, but the situation we're in is that the larger banks have a huge array of advantages over the small banks through their general coverage, but if it was targeted properly, it would not have significant impact on the small banks.
One of the reasons that's been put forward is that this is something that the banks should pay in return for getting the guarantee on deposits.
Yeah, that's right. All the banks got that guarantee. They've got that AAA guarantee. I mean, there would be no Macquarie investments left except that they had a banking licence and could access the government's AAA rating and therefore borrow internationally at the time of the Great Recession.
And this is the same firm that's known as the Millionaires Factory, isn't it?
That's right, but it would have been wiped out with all those other finance companies that were wiped out except for the banking licence. So everyone who has a banking licence had access to that that benefit of the government's AAA rating, and that helped our banks survive. It helped the small banks and the large banks. Though, of course, two of the small banks were absorbed by the bigger banks, Bankwest and St George, which significantly reduced competition and presumably was an emergency measure at that time.
And the smaller banks have also complained that for a significant period of time, their costs of borrowing is much higher than the big banks.
The smaller banks have a slightly higher cost structure, because taking away the government's AAA guarantee, all the banks are separately rated. So, you know, the risk level of the smaller bank is taken into consideration in determining their access to funds. I don't think they have a significant advantage compared to the larger banks, but I've only considered two of the smaller banks in a research project I'm running with one of my students, and the overall picture is, yes, there is a cost disadvantage, but it depends upon their own risk profile.
Considering it's likely that the Reserve Bank is going to make another cut in the cash rate, people with savings on deposit aren't going to get much, are they?
They don't at the moment, do they? Another cut in interest rates would be pretty stupid, given that at this low level of interest rates, small cuts in interest rates will have very little impact upon the economy. As we saw with the last one, so far it's had very little impact. And this would be too close to the last 0.25% cut to have properly monitored the relatively minor impact that the last one had.
But why have we got like over 2% interest rate and yet all of our trading partners are virtually down at zero?
Because they run different sorts of economies with entirely different sorts of problems. I mean, the American Central Bank printed trillions of dollars every year at the expense of low-income earners, you know, the low-income earners, to fund banks that had any sort of difficulty to buy back bonds that banks had that were, in many cases, fragile. Japan has been doing this for 20 years since the Heiko recession. The Europeans have just picked it up, despite the Germans don't like it very much. We don't have the size of these sorts of organisations, and we survived the Great Recession better than most of these others, largely because we could use both fiscal and monetary policy. Monetary policy is relatively ineffective at low interest rates like this, so you get the ridiculous policies of printing money.
But yet, if we're also looking at austerity budgets, that fiscal policy isn't doing much either, is it?
Fiscal policy has slipped out of use almost, yes, that is correct. I mean, it's interesting to see how that is managed by the new government. I mean, the government really in their new budget really needs to address the revenue issues very seriously. I mean, they talk about a spending problem. We don't have a spending problem. Proportionate to our population, we have the second lowest spending profile of any of the OECD countries. But we had a large number of unfunded tax cuts at the end of the Howard government and at the beginning of the Rudd government, and that significantly undermined the income tax base. And we've got massive tax evasion. I'm sick of people referring to this so-called avoidance as avoidance, because a lot of this is just evasion.
And Brian Andrew, do you think that the government will clamp down on benefits for the wealthy on superannuation and diesel rebates for mining companies and the like?
At this moment, I don't think the government has enough political capital to do anything radical. So I expect some tinkering to stabilise the situation and a continuance to rely upon the states to pick up the real cost of balancing the budget.
Professor Brian Andrew from the University of Wollongong's Faculty of Business, ending that report by Roderick Chambers.
On the Money, get your shake of the sauce bottle.
You're with me, Catherine Zengerer. Well, after seeing so many Australians lose their savings in dodgy Ponzi schemes or retirement plans gone wrong, many Australians put their trust and their money in the hands of the so-called Big Four banks. But that trust is now in tatters after thousands of people have lost millions by following the advice of financial planners associated with the Big Four. The Commonwealth Bank has been forced to offer up to $14 million to people to have their cases independently reviewed after they received dodgy advice. The CBA has already paid $52 million to compensate those who've lost money. ANZ has also been embroiled in the scandal. They're set to pay out $30 million in compensation, and NAB has already paid out nearly $15 million to victims of shoddy advice. A recent Senate inquiry has seen calls for a royal commission into the unethical practices that have come to light thanks to whistleblowers and disgruntled customers or their representatives. Senate Committee Chairman Labor's Sam Dastyari and Independent Senator Nick Xenophon have said the Ombudsman's service is simply not enough. They've put their support behind a national compensation scheme for victims of poor financial advice where they've been unable to recover the funds from organisations, many of which have collapsed. It's a move being supported by the Consumer Action Law Centre. Here's Senior Policy Officer Catherine Temple.
From our perspective, there's been far too many people that have suffered as a result of poor advice from a financial advisor that haven't been compensated for losses that they've suffered as a result of that advice.
At the moment, there is an option for somebody to go to the Financial Services Ombudsman. Mm-hmm. What's the problem with that?
So the Financial Ombudsman Service has awarded over $12 million to consumers, which has actually never been paid. And that's a big problem because they award compensation when there has been misconduct and the consumers have suffered loss as a result of that. And those consumers just aren't receiving that compensation. You know, there's $12 million still sitting there that hasn't been paid.
Why hasn't it been paid?
Generally, it's because the provider either goes insolvent or is missing and they lack adequate insurance. So there just isn't enough there to cover all of the claims.
At the moment, if you were to go to the Ombudsman, even if you were able to get your money back, there is a cap of $150,000. So if you've invested more than that, then that service isn't going to be of use to you, even if the Ombudsman has got the capacity to actually get that money back. In this compensation scheme idea, would there be that kind of cap on it?
I think there will be some form of cap on it, and it would be a tiered kind of award of compensation, and that also helps address some of the concerns of industry about this kind of scheme. Unfortunately, you know, there may be people, as the ones that go through the Financial Ombudsman Service that have invested more, that just won't be covered. And, you know, we'll be talking to industry and government about making sure that cap is appropriate, and it's at a fairly high percentage of what those people are owed, because, you know, it's not fair at all for people to be suffering losses due to poor advice and not seeing compensation for that.
So what kind of scheme would you think would work here?
We have been pushing for a long time for a last resort compensation scheme, and this would only be used if there's been proven misconduct by the trader and the client's been awarded compensation and the trader hasn't been able to pay that either directly or via their insurance. And this scheme, we would say, needs to be broader than just financial advice. It should be extended to the financial sector more broadly, including credit, things like payday loans, misconduct in that sector as well.
Is there an issue here about the regulations around insolvency laws too, where perhaps there ought to be some better regulation around corporations or organisations becoming insolvent that involves responsibility or some protection to creditors?
Yeah, that's certainly a valid concern. And what we're suggesting as well is that this scheme would be funded by the industry. So that would go some way while those businesses are still solvent, that they're contributing to this fund to make sure that in the event that there is compensation that is sitting there and needs to be paid, that they've contributed to this scheme to help those consumers that are waiting for the compensation they deserve.
How much do you think the industry would have to be putting in every year for this scheme to work?
It will depend on the size of the trader. I dare say it will be scalable, but we'll be discussing with industry and the government on how that should look. But I imagine it will be scalable.
How likely is it that we're going to get something like this up? Does it have support from the current federal government?
We're really hopeful that this will get up because we've been asking for a long time for this. And I think the recent publicity around all the financial planning scandals, I think, has certainly put it on the government's agenda, and we'll be pushing for them to take action on this. It really is time that consumers got a fair go and they got the compensation that they've been awarded.
We've seen these high-profile cases like those of the Commonwealth Bank and indeed the ANZ, where when they have had complaints raised by people who've lost money after receiving financial advice from them, they have forced them to sign these confidentiality agreements. What's the issue with that in your view?
Confidentiality clauses, they're commonly imposed by businesses as part of settling an individual dispute. But in our experience, confidentiality is rarely requested by the client. Usually it's used to repress public awareness of misconduct, or it can be used for that purpose. And we believe that there's a real public interest in making sure that misconduct can be brought to light and that people aren't gagged from talking about their experiences.
What's your advice to people who are looking to invest money? Because obviously there are people who have invested money in things that most people would think would probably be reasonably safe and have come out of it having lost their life savings.
That's a major concern, and I think do your research, go away, think about it. You don't need to make a decision on the day, and just remember that, you know, there are free financial counselling services out there as well. And the ASIC Money Smart website is a great resource as well. But I think just to go away and think about it long and hard, talk to your family, don't make any decisions on a whim.
At the end of the day, there is a risk that people take when they make investments, isn't there? How much of that risk should they be bearing themselves?
This has been an argument, I guess, raised by industry that a compensation scheme like this might make consumers more likely to make risky financial decisions. And that's an argument that we reject. This is a scheme of last resort. People won't be getting compensation unless there's been misconduct. And the capping that we just talked about is a way of minimising that risk as well. And we see this scheme as a way that could actually improve standards in the industry. You know, firms will want to make sure that this scheme is only called on rarely, and the scheme itself could help detect some of these problems. So we think the scheme could play a really positive role in lifting standards.
Is that really the kind of role that should be played by ASIC?
ASIC certainly plays a very important role here, and it would be complementary to ASIC's role.
Catherine Temple, Senior Policy Officer with the Consumer Action Law Centre.
On the Money. In for a podcast, in for a pound.
You're on the Money, I'm Catherine Zengerer. While the nation seems obsessed with government debt, we're clocking up pretty hefty debts of our own. Aussies owe around $44 billion on credit cards. That's an average of around $6,000 per cardholder. That's nearly $8 billion a year in interest, over $1,000 per person per year. If you're one of those people, and let's face it, that seems to be most of us, faced with multiple debts, maybe you have a credit card, a store card, a line of credit or a mortgage, which debt do you pay off first? Logic would suggest you pay off the one with the highest interest rate first. But a new study has found that, surprise, surprise, people don't always behave rationally when it comes to paying off their credit card debts. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. The same study found that people who pay off small debts first, even if they have higher interest rates, find that the motivation they get from the achievement keeps them focused on their goal of being debt-free. François Carrière from the UTS Business School co-authored the study.
What we really wanted to test is maybe people are on one hand irrational, but on the other hand, they know themselves best. And reducing debt takes a lot of self-motivation and willpower because you have to sacrifice other things and you have to be very rigorous and diligent, etc., etc. Not unlike trying to lose weight or, you know, clean up your house or something. Something not very pleasurable that you have to really push yourself to do. You need motivation to do that. And what we thought is that probably closing off an account, even if it doesn't have the highest interest rates, is not financially rational, but from a psychological, motivational standpoint, it actually makes sense because it's like you achieved one sub-goal, even if that sub-goal is not the best way to achieve the real goal, which is to reduce overall debt. But at least you close one account. And then you've got more motivational energy to keep trying to reduce your expenses or follow up on your debt and be very diligent about it.
Because this is a reality for many Australians. They don't just have one credit card. They may have many credit cards.
Yeah. I think the average in Australia is about the same as the United States, which is around four cards.
So what you found in your study is that, of course, the best way is to pay off the credit card that has the highest interest rates. What some people have been doing is managing their credit cards by doing balance transfer. They transfer to a card or an account where they have zero interest for a while, but then within a few months they're paying really high interest rates again. Your research says that people think that they're doing rational things when it comes to managing their credit card debt, but actually we're not really.
There's a short-term view to debt management, and oftentimes it boomerangs in a quite a negative way. So balance transfer could be a very rational way to manage debt, that's for sure. It just has to make sure that zero interest rate will be there long enough for you to actually pay back everything. You know, balance transfer are a powerful but dangerous instrument of debt management.
It's a bit of a lure, isn't it? Because the banks are saying, come over to us, we'll offer you zero balance when you transfer all of your debt, presumably, to that bank. And then people are trapped because sometime down the track there's a really high interest rate and they're stuck with the same problem again.
Yes, and it's very hard to get data about how many consumers are successful in erasing their debt or successfully decreasing it after using instruments such as balance transfer. It's very hard to get information about that. But what we did test was, for example, we tested situations where people had not quite enough savings to close one debt account, but close, let's say, two-thirds of the total debt. And with two-thirds of the total debt, they were focusing a lot on allocating a whole lot of money toward closing that account with the smallest interest rate. When their savings were significantly smaller proportion of the smallest credit card debt account, let's say one-third, then they will behave more rationally. They will actually allocate most of that third to the other debt accounts with higher interest rates.
Do we know why?
Yeah. The answer to that is, you know, one-third is not going to give you the impression that you have achieved a sub-goal. So the psychological, motivational reason or thrust behind the irrational behavior is not there anymore. So what you are left with is just the financial decision, and then people start making better decisions.
You found also that people are more likely to pay off a hedonistic purchase sooner than a utilitarian purchase. Can you describe what the difference is between those kind of purchases and why we pay one off before the other?
Hedonic purchases are usually pleasurable goods, a trip, a fancy dinner restaurant, something like that, something that you wouldn't deem as necessary. And utilitarian will be something you absolutely have to purchase. You know, if your car broke down and you have to get it fixed, that's considered an utilitarian purchase, for example. And this irrational, you know, debt repayment behavior, we observed it to be stronger when the debt was incurred due to hedonic purchases. And the reason for that is that hedonic products, the benefits they provide, they tend to fade away much stronger than for utilitarian goods.
So people feel guilty, is it?
They feel more guilty on one hand, which is usually not the case for utilitarian product. And on top of that, the value they get from the consumption of the good itself or the product itself, it disappears much faster. So they want to get rid of that debt faster because it's a psychological burden that is heavier.
What did you find when people have multiple debts in terms of their behavior?
We find something quite paradoxical. In fact, as people have more and more, you know, credit card debts beyond two, their irrationality tends to decrease.
That's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it?
It is counterintuitive unless you really understand why they are irrational in the first place. And the idea is to get a boost of motivation, even if it's just self-illusory. It doesn't matter. It's undoing yourself with motivation, even if it's irrational. So when you have two debt accounts and you close one, yeah, you are 50% closer to your goal, right? Or at least you feel this way. But if you have five credit card debts and you close one, you are only 20% closer to your ultimate goal of having no credit card with debts on it. So in that case, we actually observed that the irrationality of debt repayment allocation was significantly smaller.
Do you think that we have come to be just more comfortable with debt than we used to be, where we're so used to living with credit card debt that we don't tend to worry about it as much?
Absolutely. I'm not sure about the historical progression of this tendency, but at least as of today, we tested for that as well. We tested if that behavior was due to debt severity. You know, are those irrational debt repayment strategies driven by a fear of having too much debt? And we found that debt severity did not matter at all. People were not concerned whatsoever about the financial burden they had to carry.
That's very odd, isn't it? Because we seem as a nation to be incredibly worried about a national deficit, about, you know, as a nation being in debt.
Yes, that's true. I mean, there is on one level that worry and what we can hear in the media and common sense indicates that this is an issue. On the other hand, there is another layer to this. We became accustomed to, you know, where easy money and, you know, enjoy now, pay later. And this combo that credit cards offer, it's some type of, you know, conditioning, really, and it's just hard to give up.
So what would your advice be then for people who are trying to juggle either one credit card or lots of credit cards?
Focus on the debt account with the highest interest rate. Also, credit card statements don't provide this information. Maybe it would be good to actually compute it yourself for a couple of months and see. Like, calculate how much interest you pay on this card and on that card. And you could be surprised depending on different interest rates you have. The other tool is debt consolidation. But here you have to be really careful because, of course, you need to make sure the interest rate is lower than the compounded one from the multiple debt accounts. And also very important, if you consolidate, you want to go back to only one debt account, not from 4 to 2, because you might actually set yourself up for more irrationality if you stay with 2 credit card debts.
Associate Professor François Carrillard from the UTS Business School. So what can you do to reduce your credit card debts? You can head to moneysmart.gov.au where you can calculate your debts and the interest you owe. ASIC recommends stop adding more debt to your credit card, pay more than the minimum repayment, even an extra $50 per month will make a big difference. Try setting up a direct debit to pay a fixed amount off your credit card balance each payday. And if you have more than one card, pay off the one with the highest interest rate first, or tackle the one with the smallest debt first. It might give you the motivation that you need to keep going.
On the Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
Well, that's it for On the Money this week. Thanks to our reporter, Roderick Chambers. Next week, Budget Day will be almost upon us. We'll find out who key commentators think will be the winners and the losers in this year's budget. In the meantime, you can find all our podcasts at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Why not follow us on Twitter? Look for @onthemoney2ser. We'll be live tweeting the budget. You can find us on Facebook too. Look for 2ser on the money. I'm Catherine Zengerer. Thanks for your company.